Welcome to Two Way Street. Today we're going to take a look behind the scenes at the world of improvisational comedy with two of the standout members of Dad's Garage Theater, one of the best-known improv companies in the Southeast. Later, we'll talk with best-selling author and historian Joseph Ellis. In his latest book, Ellis presents an intriguing argument that if it were not for the vision of four of the founding fathers, the 13 colonies might easily have become independent nation-states with no federal rule. But first, let's talk about improv. For many actors, standing on stage with no script, waiting for a suggestion from the audience that can be turned into a scene that's funny and true, is the ultimate high-wire act of theater. When it works, it's dazzling. When it doesn't, it can be painful for audience and actors. So how do they do it? That's the question I asked our guests, Kevin Galese, the artistic director of Dad's Garage, and Amber Nash, one of the members of the company. Hey, Amber and Kevin, thanks for being here. Glad to have you here on Two Way Street. Say something funny, quick.
Uh-oh.
Now we're really in trouble. Our secret is revealed. Yeah. We have nothing in the tank.
You don't have to say anything funny. I think people are always in awe of what you're able to do working together on stage with nothing more than a suggestion of a place, an occupation, an odd prop.
People always think that it's magic, and it sometimes feels magical, but, you know, there's a lot that goes into it, a lot of years of practice and getting to know people and getting to know formats and how it all kind of works and what the rules are, and it's fun.
What are the keys to being a good improv actor?
Well, we can get into them in a second, but I think that the meta thing to know about all these rules, because you could read these rules in Tina Fey's book or in Amy Poehler's book or in any blog on improv or whatever, but I think the thing that I've learned is that these rules are deceptive. People are going to hear them, and they're going to go, oh, yeah, I get that, but they don't actually get it. It takes a lot of time to understand it, even though it's so simple. Maybe because it's so simple, it's why it takes a really long time to really figure it out.
So what does that mean?
Oh, that means, well, okay.
What's an example?
So listening.
Yes.
Listening is, I think Amber would agree, one of the most fundamental aspects of improv. Right.
Right.
Yeah. And it's like, yeah, there's listening and then there's listening.
Well, there's passive listening and there's active listening. So I'm listening, but then I'm also churning away in my mind what I'm going to be doing to add to what you just said.
All right. So we haven't rehearsed any of this, but I'm going to stop you every now and then and ask you to demonstrate some of this.
Okay,
if you will.
Sure. Sure. Yeah.
So one of you, who wants to start?
I'll start.
Okay. So you're going to start a scene.
Okay.
Kevin, once she does, you react, but then we're going to talk about what it meant when she said you're an active listener.
Okay,
great.
You want any kind of suggestion? You're just going to go.
Yeah, give us a location since we're on radio. We need to, where are we?
Oh, because you're on radio, we ought to make this something that's just an audio experience. You are at a Braille library in downtown Atlanta.
Excuse me, sir. I'm looking for... Oh, I'm sorry. I need some help finding a book.
You need to speak much more quietly.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Gregory? Is that?
That's my name, yes.
It's your voice that I recognized more than anything.
What?
Do you not recognize my voice?
Oh my God.
Susan.
Right.
From?
The bakery.
The bakery.
I'm sorry. I should have called.
Well, I know. It's been quite some time. Months. Several months.
I want to see you. Let me put my hand here and here.
Gregory, I'm just looking for a book. I wasn't looking for a...
You've changed. Yes, of course. Follow me.
Okay. That was really terrific. Listening. How did you listen to each other as you developed that scene so quickly?
Okay. Well, the first thing, Amber started by saying something. I don't remember what she said, but she started by saying something. And I listened.
I asked for help.
You asked for help. Yeah. She said, excuse me, sir. So I knew right off the bat, I knew that I worked there. and that she was a patron.
So that's we weren't familiar with one another.
Right. But also, so I listened to the words that she said, and I picked up the contextual clues about what she was trying to say in a meta sense, like what was her offer? What was her idea that she was starting with? So I need to understand her offer. But also, I listened to the tone with which she spoke, and I used that to inform my response, right? So I didn't know before she spoke that I was going to respond with shh. I did that as a response to the tone with which she initiated.
Yeah. I mean, I'm assuming when I heard you say shh, it was because you were thinking, blind people in a library, we don't want to talk too loud.
Now,
no?
See, that's the thing. I wasn't thinking about anything.
Really?
I was reacting to her.
Okay.
It's like you have to have a peaceful mind and not be thinking of these things. Because when you think of things, you fall into traps. But when you clear your mind of thought, then you can actually create cool stuff.
It's one of the fun things they talk about at UCB, which is the Upright Citizens Brigade.
Upright Citizens, one of the great improv theaters in New York and L.A., actually.
Yeah, and right before you step on stage, at least at their New York theater, there's a plaque above the door that says, don't think. And that's just kind of, you know, get out there and let your mind be open and be a conduit.
I remember there was an improviser at Dad's Garage who was struggling, and this person asked me for help and coaching so that they could get back on their game. And then I was giving them one-on-one coaching, and they said, so when you're in a scene, what are you thinking about? And I was like, are you kidding me? Oh, I think we found out what's going on with you. I'm not thinking about anything. Stop thinking. What's wrong with you? But it's because there's a voice in your head that's going, you better get this right, so you better start figuring it out.
There's another thing. We, for a while at Dad's Garage, we were doing workshops with attorneys. And one of the things that people, litigators in particular, that were in the courtroom would say when that was part of their training was to be ready but not rigid. And it paired so well with improv when we would work with attorneys, which is that it's the same idea. You have to be ready. You've got to be ready to pounce, but you can't be so ready that you can't throw away everything that you've got because you're going with the other direction of the other player.
Another thing I noticed is that you worked with each other, not against each other. How would an untrained improv actor perhaps sabotage a scene like that without even realizing it?
Let's try one.
Oh, you want to go? All right. That's a great idea. All right, so
Amber, give me the same initiation,
okay.
And I will be an untrained improviser that really wants to do a good job and is going to accidentally sabotage this.
Okay. Excuse me, sir.
Oh, hi. Look at those pants you're wearing. Wow, wow, whoa, whoa, whoa.
I can't even continue this scene.
Wait, I'm sorry. I thought we were in a library. I didn't realize I was at a stand-up comedy club.
Right, it's like I guess I may have been I might have been a little bit over the top, but like
yeah,
the
you
point
kind of
is,
a, you ru- Jenny is going to have an impossible time trying to adjust the modulation when you came in.
I'm sorry, yeah, but it's true. It's like it's just you're out of control. Yeah. You don't know what you're doing. You're trying so hard to get a laugh. There's no stakes. There's no relationship. You're making a joke out of everything. You're not setting your partner up to succeed. And everything feels forced and fake.
Well, I was going to say that that's a very obvious way to say that you sabotage things. But there are a little bit more subtle ways that improv can go wrong. So,
sure,
for instance,
sure.
Amber, you created a situation, and or maybe it was you, Kevin, who suggested you already knew Amber. Who said
well,
it first?
I did, and I'll tell you why. And it was a cheat. And here's what happened: is I set up a scene, and I did it incorrectly. And what I did was I suggested that we didn't know each other. And so in my improv brain, I started backpedaling because I was like, well, it's going to be a lot harder.
You're not supposed to do that.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot harder for us to get a scene going if we don't know each other.
But he could have. But okay. So you started the notion that you did know each
yes.
other. Now, Kevin, another somewhat more subtle way to sabotage a scene is to work against your partner and say, no, I think you're wrong. I don't think we've ever met before.
So one of the, yeah, you're right. You're right. So we talked about listening. Now we have to talk about the idea of like saying yes. You have to say yes. If people are contributing ideas and there's no right or wrong and you're just figuring out as you go, and you say no, you're essentially going, yeah, there's no right or wrong except for your idea. That's wrong. I'm not. I reject that. I do not accept your contribution to this creative process, which is, first of all, it destroys the scene. But second of all, it destroys the kind of creative relationship you have with your partner and erodes the trust.
Such a team sport. Like, really, improv is such a team sport. There are people that do solo improv, but they're still improvising with the audience and with suggestions. And so one of the things we talk about all the time is, like, the whoa, whoa, whoa guy would be the worst person to do stuff with, because a lot of it is you have to trust your partner, but you also have to be a good improviser to work with. And so there are people that are brilliant and crowd pleasers and the audience loves them, but people don't like playing with them because they're just looking out for themselves and they're not looking out for the scene and the story and their partner.
That's right. A lot of audience members probably don't realize that, like, they might see someone on stage and go, oh, I love that guy. And everyone backstage is going, I hate that guy.
And the reason that guy looks good is because there's improvisers on stage that are letting him do what he does and setting up a situation for him to look really good while he's steamrolling everybody else.
Yeah, back in the day, a good example of that is Joan Rivers.
Yeah.
Failed at Second City, one of the great improv theaters in the country, because what she wanted to do was stand-up comedy. And that's just not the way you're going to succeed if you're part of a company.
Yeah, improv and stand-up are opposites and the same. So they're the yin and yang.
We should say you two are married.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it'd be interesting to talk about the life lessons you get out of the work you do, especially in the context of your own relationship. Listening. Teaching people how to listen has enormous value, yes?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, it's about communication and how much we're actually communicating and how superficial or how in-depth that communication is happening. And I think that if you understand that when you're listening to someone, just hearing the words is just the tip of the iceberg, then I think you're on your way to actually being able to communicate well with others.
One of the things that is another rule that just sprung to mind that we talk about a lot is not being afraid to fail. And, like, it's such a huge part of it. And I think that is another thing that kind of creeps into our personal life, too, is, like, we can do anything's possible if you're not afraid of failing. And so it just kind of leads to great things when you're just moving through life not afraid of failure.
Yeah, yeah, we definitely.
And we fail all the time in huge, hilarious ways in front of audiences. But sometimes that's where the best comedy comes from, is just screwing up really bad.
And also, I think that there's something innately kind of, like, endearing about somebody who's, like, willing to, like, show you their stumbles.
Yep.
They go, man, I'm not perfect. Look at what I just did. That was, like, really, really embarrassing. And you all saw it.
And I think, too, for Kevin and I in particular in our life, is that because we're improvisers, we're really lucky that we have, like, a super fun life that we get to live all the time. And so we're just kind of, we laugh a lot at home and in our personal lives, because we just, like, we're kind of on the same plane of, like, kookiness just in general, like how we live our lives and move through the world. And like, one thing that I like to tell people, it's such a fun story, is Kevin and I went to a resort in Jamaica for our honeymoon. And while we were at this resort on, like, Wednesday night, they had a talent competition for people staying at the resort. And Kevin and I were like, well, we gotta enter this talent competition. And so we were like, well, what are we going to do? And we thought the easiest thing for people to be able to click into was a word at a time story, which is a short form game. And the winner gets 3 free nights at a resort in Jamaica. And the first year we did it, we've been there twice, 3 times actually, we didn't win. But the second time we won and we got 3 free nights in Jamaica.
Was it you got better at doing the word game, or that there were other people who were better than you at doing whatever they did?
Yeah, no, I don't know. I think it was just like the judges were like, oh, we liked when that other guest did that Celine Dion song.
All right. No, remember, it was the Russian pianist.
Oh, that guy, yeah.
Yeah. There was like 12 acts.
The winner of the Van Cliburn International Piano Competition is going to beat you guys.
This, like, 70-year-old Russian man comes up and is like, okay, now I play this thing. And he's like, it's like everyone's weeping because it's so beautiful.
And we're like, well, I guess our stupid story's not going to win.
What is the game that you were just talking about?
So it's called a word at a time story. It's a short form game that you'd see in, like, a theater sports show or any other short form show. And And basically, you and a partner, sometimes more people, but usually it's done with two people, go back and forth creating a story, but each person can only say one word at a time.
Want to do it?
Sure.
We do. Yeah, let's do one. I just wanted to say something about it first for you to look at is like the reason that this is like a foundational or a fundamental improv lesson game that we used to teach in early improv lesson is like I can't have my own idea because if she says something that contradicts it, then I need to go with what's happening, right? So it's this like lesson in like letting go of your own ideas and just building off of what's in front of you.
And this is one of the tools that helps you get to the point where you aren't thinking and you've got a blank mind for
sure. So you can do this exercise on its own, but it also teaches you to be better at the scene stuff that we were doing earlier.
Mm-hmm. So what should our listeners be listening for as you two do this?
See if you can see where one of us is trying to take something and then the other person takes it somewhere else and watch us drop whatever we had and try to get on the other person's page.
Love it. You want it? You need a suggestion again?
Sure. Yeah.
You know,
maybe just another location.
Jenny says Arabia Mountain in DeKalb County.
Okay. One
day
I
woke
up
as
early
as
I
could
and
donned
my
super
outfit
and
decided
that
I
was
going
to
patrol
the
park,
not
looking
for
criminals,
but
looking
for
dog
droppings
because
I
believe
in
cleanliness.
So
I
took
my
trusty
picker
upper
and
went
into
the
park.
It
was
right
about
dawn.
The
air
was
sweet
and
moist
and
hot.
The
birds
were
singing
like
beautiful
musicians.
Looking
around,
I
noticed
that
there
was
a
gigantic
steaming
pile
of
dog
shit.
So
I
went
and
picked
it
up
with
my
picker
upper.
But
it
was
so
big
that
my
picker
upper
broke
in
half
and
I
was
at
the
mercy
of
the
gods.
So
I
fell
to
my
knees
and
cried
to
the
heavens,
dear
God,
why
have
you
forsaken
me?
So
at
that
moment,
a
bird
landed
on
my
shoulder
and
tweeted,
please
remember
your
duty.
So
I
looked
at
the
ground
and
saw
the
turd
and
I
took
my
hand
and
jammed
it
into
the
pile
and
picked
it
up
with
my
strength
and
heaved
it
into
a
appropriate
receptacle.
The
moral
of
the
story
is
believe
that
anything
is
possible
when
God
speaks
to
you
through
a
bird.
Wow.
The end.
That was really nicely done.
Thank you.
Congratulations. Thank you for doing that. So once again, you're listening to each other. But the amazing thing always about that game is you don't have time to think.
Right.
Right. You if you're trying to cure yourself of thinking, that game will help you get that.
Yeah.
You're doing everything you can when your turn comes and you've got one word to say and you're trying to communicate where you have an idea to take something, do everything you can to communicate out your idea. But also know that if the other person doesn't get it and they go in another direction, you're just going to chuck it to the wayside and try to follow their idea. And hopefully by both parties doing that, you can kind of get into that magical space where you're both on the same page and you're not really sure who's leading and who's following.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about improvisational theater with Amber Nash and Kevin Galise of Dad's Garage Theater. After a break, we'll have more of our conversation, and we'll give them suggestions to create a few more scenes right here in our studio. You're listening to Two-Way Street.
Welcome back to Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. Let's continue now with our conversation about the art of improv with Kevin Galese and Amber Nash of Dad's Garage Theater. Does it still scare you sometimes to be standing up there naked on the stage in terms of your craft? Or is it so exhilarating that you've lost that sense of, oh my God, am I going to succeed or fail tonight?
For me, I am so comfortable doing improv that it's as easy as taking a shower. But if I do scripted work, it is terrifying. And so, like, we just finished a run at Dad's of a scripted show that one of our improvisers wrote. And every night before I stepped on stage, it was like I was going to have a heart attack and die. But if I'm doing an improv show, it's like I just waltz out there like it's no big deal because there's nothing to think about.
Yeah.
It's just so free and open. But yeah. I think everybody's kind of different.
All right. Could we do one more scene?
Yeah.
Can I give you a situation?
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Give us whatever you want.
Really?
And then, yeah, we'll just do a straight up scene.
Okay.
But here's my situation.
Okay.
Okay.
One of you is a shock jock
okay.
who has lost the job, is desperate for work, and so is actually applied to be an on-air host at National Public Radio.
Okay, great. Well, your resume looks great. We would, honestly, we'd be very, very happy to have you here at National Public Radio.
I know that I'm not exactly what you imagine when you are hiring a new host. I know that some of my skills and some of my experience is a little different. I just want to let you know, I will work so hard to restrain any of my prior aesthetic from creeping into the fabulous work you're doing
now,
here.
Now, speaking of that, I do want to go over your rider here that you provided us with.
Sure.
One of the things that we can't provide you with in your new job is the toilet flushing sound effect.
Okay, that's fine. I
can't do that.
Yeah.
And we are not going to get you a co-host, a hype man, a, you know, whatever it is you're looking for there.
Okay. Yeah.
Asked for Stripper Tuesday. We are not going to allow you to have strippers in the studio on Tuesday mornings.
Okay. Well, it did. It got pretty good ratings.
Yeah, but that was at 97Q.
Yeah.
The Rock
The Wolf.
Station. Yeah. Yeah, I'm familiar with The Wolf.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yes, of course. No Stripper Tuesdays. I don't need a wacky co-host. I will ditch the flushing sound effect. I am ready to move on with my career, and I'm telling you, I am ready to kind of reinvent myself.
Well, then let me ask you, what's your first big story? What are you going to lead with? How are you going to really get your teeth sunk into what we do here?
Okay, well, I thought that I might just really explore the there's something going down at this Ford dealership, and everybody's got to keep their hand on a car, and then when the last person to have their hand on the car wins the car, and so I wanted to just grab some beers and hang out with those guys, and I thought that might be a good opener, but if that's not the right kind of content,
you know what? I'm sorry, I spoke too soon. I don't think we are quite ready to have you here at National Public Radio.
Is it because I have frosted tips? Is this about my hair? Is it because I've bleached the tips of my hair?
The fact that you call it frosted, which is a term that hasn't been used since the mid '90s, is very concerning to me.
Well, this is humiliating. Goodbye.
Please don't leave those strippers in the lobby.
Come on, girls.
Thank you both very much for taking my suggestion and working with it. Okay, so choices. Big part of an actor's work.
Mm-hmm.
The choices you make. I was interested in the dynamic that you created because you made the choice that you would, Kevin, you are going to be on your best NPR behavior. You wanted, your choice was, I really want this job, so I'm going to come in restrained and completely willing to do what she says. What would have happened if the choice you had made was to bring your shock jock persona to an NPR interview? That scene would have developed in an entirely different way, and it would have been just as valid, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And Amber would have reacted differently.
You want to try it?
Sure.
Great. Come on in. Have a seat. It's great that you're here.
Oh, good to be here. You are looking great. Wow.
Well, thank you. You certainly do have a lot of energy.
I always bring the caffeinator. That's what I'm drinking, my special energy drink that I'm hawking.
Fantastic. So you're applying for the job as a host for our new radio show here at NPR.
You said it.
That's right.
Don't forget it.
That's the name of the show. You said it. Don't forget it. And you you interview different people that have had problems with amnesia and memory loss.
That's right. I want to get inside the minds of the people.
It's not fair of me to ask you to do too much work. I thought you just gave us a great example of how the choice that an actor makes in an improv makes all the difference in a scene.
Yeah.
It's really interesting.
And so you always have to kind of counterbalance things to a certain degree, right? Like it's a step-counter-step kind of thing, right? And so when I was being restrained and on my best behavior, Amber was trying to kind of pull me towards
absolutely
it,
and
right?
The burden of the scene the first time around was really on you.
Right.
You introduced the no strippers. You introduced all those shock jock elements. Mm-hmm. You carried the burden of that scene in a different way than the second time you did it, right?
Right.
And then in the second one, because I was coming out guns a-blazing, she was trying to pull me towards NPR. She'd go, right, so you're doing a show about people with brain injuries. It's like, that's right.
Well, I that was wonderful to hear that example of your work. Look,
we're
out of time. Your work is terrific, and so I'm really pleased that you could come in and be part of our show today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. I had a blast.
Good. Amber Nash and Kevin Galese are performers with Dad's Garage Theater. The company celebrates its 21st anniversary in just a couple of weeks. They perform a lot of different kinds of improv at Dad's Garage, including a Saturday night ongoing Atlanta-based soap opera called Scandal. You can find information about Dad's Garage on the Two-Way Street website at gpb.org/TWS. After a break, just what did we celebrate earlier this week on the 4th of July? Historian Joseph Ellis tells us we may have the wrong idea of what the signing of the Declaration of Independence really meant for America. Welcome back to Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. We're going to talk now with best-selling author and historian Joseph Ellis. His latest book, The Quartet, has just been released in paperback. The timing of our conversation is perfect since we celebrated the 4th of July earlier this week. But what were we celebrating? In The Quartet, Ellis argues that our commonly held assumption that the United States became a nation with the signing of the Declaration of Independence is just plain wrong. And he says if it were not for the visionary thinking of four of our founding fathers, George Washington, James Madison, John Jay, and Alexander Hamilton, the United States may have remained a collection of independent nation states.
The first clause in the first sentence of the most famous speech in American history is historically incorrect.
Four score and seven years ago,
our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation. No, they didn't. They brought forth a confederation of sovereign states provisionally and temporarily united to win the war against Great Britain and then go their separate ways, which is what they did. And the kind of government they created, it wasn't really a government. It wasn't even supposed to be a government. It's called the Articles of Confederation. It's really like a League of Nations. Each colony, now state, was a separate nation. So the legislatures and the states were sovereign. And the Lincoln explanation is wrong. Now, Lincoln had to falsify history in 1863.
He was dating it to the Declaration of Independence.
That's right. 67
right.
is, but the next part of that sentence, 67, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. We know what he's talking about there.
Right.
It's the Declaration of Independence. It's Jefferson's document. But that he, in 1863, had to make the case that we were a union from the start, because otherwise the South, the Confederate States of America, could claim that they have history on their side, which in fact they did. If you take 1776 as the founding moment, they don't have it if you take 1787-88.
So let's do a time. Let's get a timeline
All right.
that our listeners understand, because what you are about to say has particular resonance sitting here in a studio in Atlanta, Georgia, and we'll talk a little bit about that as we move forward. But so, 1776, Thomas Jefferson writes the Declaration of Independence. Again, as you say, not a document bringing together the 13 separate colonies as a unified body.
And the resolution on July 2nd, voting independence, that these colonies are and have every right to be independent states.
Sovereign.
Sovereign.
Yeah, yeah. So that's 1776. 1777, the Continental Congress passes the Articles of Confederation.
Right.
They're not ratified till 81.
Right. They got this thing going on called the war, and which gets in the way, you know. And what they do is create a government of sorts that's a confederation, a voluntary collection of sovereign states who meet to discuss what they have in common. And what you figure out pretty quickly is that they are jealous of their own individual sovereignties, and that, for example, all taxes are voluntary.
Yeah.
Think about that. You know, like, and this is one of the things that undermined the war effort, too, because levies and taxes for the Continental Army were also voluntary.
Yeah, you point out at one point there was a call for $3 million to be paid by the colonies to help the war effort. For the war effort, how much did they collect?
I forget.
$39,000.
Right.
You write.
Okay. So that you can see that each colony wants to take a cum state. They're now a state. Wants to take care of its own people. And therefore, they will do things with the militia rather than the Continental Army. But we really are a republic. We are a banana republic. If you say, what kind of republic are we? We are a banana republic. We have a debt of about $40 million, and we can't pay it. And nobody cares. And the average American is born, grows up, dies within a 28-mile radius. They don't have the internet. They don't have cell phones. And therefore, their allegiances are local rather than larger, at most state-based.
And why wouldn't they want them to be local? They've just been fighting a war
right.
to free themselves from the tyranny of a central government.
Correct. Which is one of the things the anti-federalists are going to argue in the ratification process. The answer to them is yes, but in Parliament, we didn't have any representation. And in Congress that we've just created, of course, you have representatives, to which then guys like Patrick Henry will say, well, wait a minute. Suppose all the representatives from the other states vote for a tax and the representatives from Virginia don't. We're being taxed without our consent. Now, you can hear some of these things still in certain states like Texas right now, okay?
Georgia might be another
Georgia
one.
Georgia might be close. And it's not democracy versus aristocracy. It's confederation versus nation. It's a definition of representation that is proximate versus a definition of representation that is a bit further away.
Just to make the point about how crazy some of this could get, the various states were able to make claims that no one could challenge. Georgia, you point out, for instance, decided to ignore the treaties with a number of Indian tribes.
Right. They signed their own treaties, especially the Creeks. They really wanted that land out there in western Georgia.
Right.
So they just found some Creek guy and they signed a treaty with him. And then the Creek said, wait a minute, he doesn't represent us.
And George had also at that point, I think you say, at that point claimed that its land extended to the Mississippi River.
It said its original charter extended to the Mississippi
Virginia River. Said its western border was the Pacific Ocean.
That was their broadest claim, yes, although you can't get much broader. But when they were founded, see, the map made it look like the Pacific was about 200 miles from the Alleghenies. So that nobody knew back then. These are outrageous claims, and that's what's going on up and down the seaboard. New York's also charging tariffs to Massachusetts. Massachusetts has its own foreign policy. Virginia doesn't want to recognize any national government because most all the Tidewater planters are heavily in debt. They're $3 million in debt to people in England, and they just want to finesse that. So it's a cacophony.
It is very hard for us to imagine today, and this is where your book is stunning in a way, that we really didn't understand or see ourselves as coming together,
right,
that we really wanted to be separate entities. But your four heroes, if that's a fair enough word.
They're heroes to me. I mean, I think it's a good idea we became a nation state.
Yeah.
And if you don't, then you won't like this book. But you could legitimately say that these guys stage a kind of benevolent coup d'etat.
They all had the vision to
understand,
for various reasons, why we had to unify.
Right.
The first man they had to have as part of this was George Washington.
You got to get Washington. This is going to be a slightly illegal and illegitimate operation.
Because what they're going to do is try to come together in the Continental Congress and create this unified country.
In a constitutional convention. And they'll want to try to come together in the constitutional convention. And their mandate from the Confederation Congress is to reform the Articles of Confederation. They're going to violate that. They're going to try to replace them. Not only that, but according to the Articles, the mandate is you have to have a unanimous vote for this to approve. They say, well, we're never going to get unanimous vote because Rhode Island is, you know, always going to boycott everything. Therefore, we'll just decide it's 9 votes. They just pull that out of the air. But in order for them to make this work, the indispensable character has to be Washington.
Why?
Because he is the foundingest father of them all.
Yeah.
And because nobody agrees as to what the American Revolution really means, except whatever it is, he's it.
Yeah, you write about him. You write about him, his physical size.
Yeah.
Nobody knows exactly how tall he was.
They disagree. If you go to Mount Vernon, they say 6'2". When they measured him for his casket, it was 6'3¼" and 202 pounds. But now some people say they bent his toes when they were measuring him in the casket. So you can say between 6'2 and 6'3¼". But mostly, he's the guy who won the war.
Yeah.
And it's going to be hard to get him, though, because at the end of the war, at Annapolis, where the Continental Congress is still meeting, they move around like a circus, he surrenders his sword. Big deal. George III is told that George Washington has refused to the crown and has surrendered his sword. And George III says, if it is true, he will be the greatest man in the world.
You point out he wasn't so much an intellect as he was dedicated to persevering, essentially.
He was a man with grit, as we would say, with resilience, but also judgment. That's his central quality. He gets all the big things right, and he gets them right before it's clear what to do. In other words, he commits to opposing Great Britain in a war before it's ever clear that we have any chance at all at winning, and he commits to this constitutional convention before it's clear that it's going to work at all. It doesn't look like it's going to work. He gives it a fighting chance, and he says the only way I'll do it is if we go for broke. But he gets talked into it. There's another thing. He thinks he's going to die. Every man in the Washington line dies in their 50s, and he's in his early 50s at this time. He really doesn't want, and later on when he becomes president, no president in American history did not want to be president more than George Washington.
He was, and I think you've pointed this out in at least one other book, Washington kept wanting to retire. He won the war. He wanted to go back to Mount Vernon, live his life out there. They drafted him to be part of the Constitutional Convention. Later, of course, he becomes president, doesn't really want it. Then he's got to run for a second term. He doesn't want
to do that. Right. And you know, like if you're, I've written a book about him, a biography called His Excellency, but that when you're reading the presidential years, half the letters are about Mount Vernon. And they're back to Mount. That's where he wanted to be.
Is it fair to say that if each of the four in the quartet that you write about has a reason for wanting to be part of this effort to create a unified country, Washington's piece of it is he truly believes the vision. He believes the necessity, the general idea of it. Alexander Hamilton believes in the vision because he's terribly concerned about the financial state of the 13 colonies and what will become of them. We have terrible debt. We have no way to pay it off. Is that so? Hamilton's stake is a solid financial basis for the whole country.
It's true. It looks more so that way since we know he becomes Secretary of Treasury. He, like Washington, thought that we almost lost the war because we weren't united. And that we could have won it in 2 years if you'd actually given us what we wanted. So he's very conscious of what a loose confederation means in terms of coherence.
Who is John Jay, and what's his role in all this?
John Jay is a guy from New York who is much more prominent among his peers back in the late 18th century. They all thought like Jay would be have monuments made to him. He's the first guy to write Washington and say, you got to come out of retirement. We're going to do this thing. We're going to change this government. And you're the only, he's the first guy to do that.
Their goal is to manipulate, that's a fair word, I think, the Constitutional Convention to come around to creating a United States of America.
Right.
And they have a couple of really big stumbling blocks. One of them is slavery.
Yep. There is no mention of slavery directly in the Constitution. The word, the euphemism is that species of property. The dilemma is this. Most of the 55 members of Congress, including of the convention, including people that own slaves, including people from Georgia and South Carolina and Virginia, realized that slavery violated the values of the Revolution. It was, however, a necessary evil. Necessary because the entire economy of the South depended on it, especially once you get down to South Carolina. South Carolina is 60% African American population, and the economy is embedded in this institution. Therefore, any attempt to end slavery, either directly or by extension over time, destroys the possibility of ever passing the Constitution. The initial thing was to end the slave trade now, and they make a deal. You can extend the slave trade for 20 years in return for, it doesn't have to be a supermajority for tariffs, it's only a majority, which is an advantage for the northern states. Most of the founders, including my four quartet guys, think if you confine it to the deep South, it'll die a natural death. They don't see the cotton gin. They don't see the cotton kingdom. So they make this compromise, and it's abolitionists will call it a covenant with death. Mm-hmm. But face it, if you tried to end it in the summer of 1787 at the convention, it blew up the whole idea of a successful American nation state. Washington and the founders create the nation that Lincoln's going to save. There wouldn't be anything to save if they didn't create it in the first place. And I think that it's interesting. Suppose they said, okay, the North is going to go its own separate way. That what happens then with slavery? I mean, there's nobody to oppose it. And like the Cotton Kingdom is going to sign treaties with England because it's going to supply them with cotton for the whole 19th century. It's history would have moved off in a different way, but it's not in an attractive way. And so a New Englanders, we're going to separate from this. We just don't want to be contaminated. No, that would have been a mistake.
We obviously know that your quartet, with the aid of others at the Constitutional Convention, was able to actually create the United States of America.
Right. Ratification is weird. It's really hard to understand. But 12 states, Rhode Island boycotts the whole thing, have these debates running from October of 1787 to, or November of 1787 to July of 1788, okay? Now you think about it, that's the great debate in American history. I mean, you've got every state coming together trying to figure out whether or not we should become a nation or stay a confederation. If you try to read all the debates in each state, which I have had to do, what you discover is it's a cacophony. they cannot have a national conversation. Each state looks at this from the point of view of its own interest, and then within the state, different counties and different sections of the state. The only document that has a national perspective is the Federalist Papers, which makes it, that's what makes it a distinctive thing. So one of the things I'm really saying is that the Constitution doesn't create a nation. We're still not a nation after the Constitution. The Constitution creates a framework in which a national ethos can incubate and grow over time.
Because we are in the South.
Yes, we are.
I'd like to hear your thoughts about the fact that, particularly during the Obama administration, we like to think that the Civil War resolved once and for all the supremacy of the federal government over the individual states.
I would think that would pretty much of a—I mean, that's a big war, 632,000 casualties, and that was what it was fought about.
And yet we see in the headlines, the state of Georgia just sued the federal government because it opposes the Obama administration's ruling about transgender students using the bathroom that they identify with. We see states suing the Obama administration over the Affordable Care Act. We see increasingly, I think, in the conservative South, of movement toward trying to pull back rights that many Southerners think they've lost.
I mean, I'm a Southern. I'm from Virginia. Okay, my wife's from Mississippi. Yes, it's a time to be concerned. It doesn't mean to throw up your hands. And to me, looking back at the 18th century allows us to have arguments together. It's not going to give us the answers, but if we can go back there and argue together, it begins to help us talk to each other in a more collective way.
Well, your book, Joe Ellis, does certainly. Another thing that I think is really important, it reminds us of how inspiring the vision was of these four founding fathers particularly.
Yeah.
This is an inspired vision of what the best possible world could be. We just have to live up to what they had in mind for us.
At their best, yes.
Yes.
There's going to be some scoundrels back there, too.
Well, sure.
But yes. And I think, again, that if we go back there and try to come to terms with what they're saying, it allows us, it doesn't give us the solutions, but it allows us to begin to develop a political vocabulary that allows us to talk to each other about matters which right now we have a tough time talking about.
Joe Ellis, thank you so much for spending time with us today. It's been a real pleasure to get to talk to you.
My pleasure.
Joseph Ellis is the author of The Quartet. It's just been released in paperback. If you'd like to learn more about what the critics are saying about the book, check out the Two-Way Street website at gpb.org/TWS or go to our Facebook page. Before we leave you today, a quick note about next week's Two-Way Street. We're putting the finishing touches on a show about dogs. We're going to talk with author Bronwyn Dickey, who's getting a lot of attention and not all of it positive for her new book, Pitbull, The Battle Over an American Icon. Dickey tells the story of how a dog that was once an American favorite gained a reputation as being the most dangerous dog in the world. Her conclusion that the Pitbull has been unfairly maligned has made her the target of death threats and online harassment.
You really have to wonder, since there's no science behind any of this, you know, what is this really about for us? And more than anything, I think it's the need to kind of carve out something so that we know what to be afraid of, you know?
You can listen to the interview and draw your own conclusions. We're also going to talk with Atlanta author Melissa Faye Green. She's written a heartwarming new book about helper dogs. They're trained to comfort and assist adults and children with emotional, cognitive, and physical disabilities. If you're a dog lover, you won't want to miss next week's show.
Remember, you can listen to Two-Way Street on your own timetable by subscribing to our podcast at iTunes or your favorite podcast provider. You can check out the archive of past shows on our website. This week, I'm happy to introduce a new member of the Two-Way Street producing team. Trevor Young joins us as assistant producer. Trevor's been part of the GPB news team, and we're very glad he's moving over to work on Two-Way Street. Welcome, Trevor. Our producer is the always fabulous Jenny Amond. Our interns are Caroline Hayes and Hannah Rose Adams. I'm Bill Nygut. Thanks for listening. I hope to see you here again next week for another Two-Way Street.